Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks. As per usual, we are diving straight in. Carly, will you please kick us off?
We have a little preamble that I'm not going to read, but obviously it's always nice when you guys write us a little personalized note that we can kind of, you know, chuckle to ourselves about. So thank you always for that. Okay, so this one coming in at 487, here we go. Dear Ms. Waters, I'm writing to seek representation for my debut work of literary fiction, Only Now We Are. Complete at 105,000 words, set against the backdrop of an economic crisis, the novel follows a group of disillusioned millennials who abandon a world they deem irredeemably broken to found a new society in the Midwest. Part social critique, part allegory of self-discovery, Only Now We Are will appeal to readers captivated by the prospect of new beginnings, as seen in Gabriel Bump's The New Naturals. First fired, then dumped. The narrator's attempt to escape the gravity of childhood and propel himself into adulthood is crashing back to earth. Only the mouth in his mantra of burn it down rebellion and his new friends, Regina, Squire, and Hawk, can pull him from the brink of a quarter-life crisis. When the narrator puts their movement in the spotlight through some impromptu civil disobedience, the group organizes a march on the Capitol that ends in tear gas and pepper balls. Their disillusionment complete, they decide to abandon the Capitol to form a new society in a derelict washing machine factory in Isadora. Isolated in the dead of winter, they each begin putting together the pieces of their ideal society, of their own Isadora. The mouth wants to rule the world without breaking a sweat and elevates the narrator to a godlike high through dogma and ritual. His propaganda glorifies their struggle and convinces followers to join them. Regina, the agriculturalist, plants seeds and nurtures Isadora's growth. Hawk, the industrialist, lights a forge and tries to bend the world to his will. Squire, the errand boy, seeks to replicate the simple virtues he once knew beyond Isadora's walls. For a time, these visions of Isadora each coexist in precarious harmony, like concentric circles orbiting the narrator at the center. It should be paradise, but it takes a lot to run a new society. Food, money, justice, peace, glorious revolution gives way to banal governance, and with each decision made, Isadora begins to look more and more like the world they left behind. Breaking the society's cardinal rule, the narrator begins sneaking off compound and starts a love affair with a woman from outside the community. With the foundations of the new society beginning to crumble, the narrator must choose between doubling down a perpetual revolution or making peace with the world beyond Isadora. I've always been drawn to powerful books whose substance or style leaves an indelible mark. Despite going to school in Iowa, I was drawn more to caucuses than writers' workshops, and have since built a career in foreign relations that has spanned the globe and has me currently living in Dakar, Senegal. My year observing the unique ways societies thrive and the common ways they fail inspired me to write this book. I would be delighted to share it with you, full manuscript at your request. Sincerely, redacted.
Thank you, Carly. So what's your take on that?
All right. This was a really interesting one because this is one of those examples where I'm like, I wish the author was here so we could talk about it. Because I'm like, is this our world? Is it not our world? How much of this world is our world? So I had a lot of questions around the world building piece. I will also say there was about 4 spelling errors in this. And again, I know this is a educational platform, but I'm a literary agent and, you know, you only get one look with a literary agent sometimes. So obviously just want to underscore the importance of, you know, making sure that we're always spell checking everything really, really carefully. Okay. So as I said, yeah, I definitely want to know like how much of this is our world and how much of it is not, because it definitely influences how it's pitched. Because you say against the backdrop of an economic crisis, you don't say which one, you say millennials, Midwest, like these are obviously things that we understand in our world, but also these could be fast forward, you know, I don't know, like 10 years and we're still millennials. So I don't know, the millennials didn't really like ground me in place necessarily. But then below, then you say a quarter life crisis. So then they're like 25 and they're millennials. So then this is kind of presumably, if I'm doing a bit of math, this is about 10 years ago, right? So anyway, I was a little bit confused about the world. And there isn't a lot of world building. And we'll talk about world building a little bit more at the pages. But there isn't really a lot of world building here, other than the idealized world building, that's the intellectual kind of world building that's happening. And I would love to know a bit more of like the on the ground world building here. Okay, so the friends bit. So we name the friends, the Regina, Squire, Hawk, and the Mouth. I mean, they seem obviously very important as characters, but I don't know if we need to name them all in the query letter. I would almost say like, you know, the group of friends and da 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 da, and they kind of go off and build their own world. I think that would be pretty important. The other big picture note that I have about this is, what are we rebelling against? Because this is a very like intellectualized project, but it isn't very clear like what they are trying to reconfigure in their new world. So it seems like, yeah, they're just disillusioned with our world. They go and build a new world. But I'm like, what do they think is going to be new in their world? And then they're disappointed that it's like, oh, we need food, money, justice, peace. Like, we need all of these things. But I'm like, is this a alternate history, alternate future book? Is this dystopian? Like, I'm just trying to figure out the why of it all, because I think that would really greatly shape how this kind of project is pitched. Because here's the thing, if we don't know what they're fighting against, we don't know where the passion is coming from and what the motivation is. And that left me very like distant from this world they're trying to build, because I don't understand the heart of the struggle. You know what I mean? Like, if something happened to this character that was very much like, you know, a family member died because of something, something, something. And then it's like, that's where we get the energy to like go on this big journey. That type of thing is what I was waiting for. But this is kind of like, they get fired and then they get dumped. And then this is what makes their world crash down. It's a little bit superficial to me personally. And it could be there's so many more layers to this I'm not getting in the query letter. But I'm just really concerned that I don't know their values and the passion and the motivation. If you're going to put society aside and go build a new world, you have to have a fire in you. And I just couldn't figure out what the fire was necessarily. And yeah, I was just really curious about like, you know, why do they want to build this community? How do they think it's going to be different? I left you some notes in here about like some things you can cut. But overall, I think it has to be more concise. I think we have to kind of hone in on the world building. Yeah, and those are kind of my main notes.
Thank you, Carly. Cece?
So the preamble, which Carly didn't read, mentioned that I don't pull punches, which gave me a laugh because I was like, oh man, I'm the Simon Cowell of the group, which fair. But since you mentioned that I don't pull punches, I just wanted to say, I don't understand what your story is about. This is a very long query letter. And if I had to shoot a trailer for it, I couldn't. And it's interesting because Carly focused on the fact that we might have to zoom out a little bit more and understand the world building with more precision. And I agree. But I also think we need to zoom in more. We get one-liners on some of these characters, and these are not one-liners that are specific on the plot. So it's something like, the Mouth wants to rule the world without breaking a sweat and elevates the narrator to a godlike high through dogma and ritual. I have no idea what that looks like. Truly, I don't. So to me, I was lost. I don't know what your story is about, which I think is a problem. It could be a me problem. It could just be that, hey, this book isn't for me. It's not my style of book and someone else will get it. And that's great if that's the case and you can totally ignore me. But yeah, and I also think you need one more comp. I, again, don't know your story super well, but just based on your first paragraph, you know, creating a new society, which I really liked. I really liked that first paragraph. You might want to take a look at You're an Animal by Jardine Lebert. Apologies if I'm butchering her name. That is a beautifully written book. Like, she is such a talent. So it might be a good comp for you. I don't actually know. But yes, I will be honest and not pull punches and say that I did not understand what the story is about.
Yeah, thank you, Cece. Again, as an author, feel the pain. I'd rather write a million books than one query letter, so I feel you guys. Okay, Carly, what was in those opening pages?
All right, so in these opening pages, it says part one, chapter one. We are in the moment when our main character is getting fired, as was promised to us in the query letter itself. There is a bit of kind of, I'm not sure if it's like internal dialogue or actual dialogue with the person doing the firing about like the way that he's being fired or kind of deciding how he's going to be let go, that type of thing. There's some metaphors about kind of the relationship between, you know, being let go and like how it's kind of like a fish, like catch and release and that sort of thing. We're learning a little bit about, you know, being after college and moving to the capital and kind of this job we get the sense it's very much like a cubicle type of situation and another kind of worker in the cog of capitalism type of situation. That's kind of the energy here. Okay. And so we also learned that he lives with the Mouth, which was a character that was introduced in the query letter. And there's a bit of dialogue about, are you moving out and kind of figuring out the situation. There's some dialogue about what it's like to be a cog in the machine in the capital, and they're having a discussion about people who move there and try to get jobs and what the purpose is, and kind of like an intellectualized conversation. And that's where it ends.
Great, Carly. Okay, we're going to kick it to Cece now so that she can discuss her take on that, and then we'll come back to you after that.
I read it different. I read it as not he lives with the Mouth, but he met the Mouth, and we got the conversation on the day that he met the Mouth. And he was complaining about gentrification, but he didn't mean it. He said that it was just, and he thinks that no one else means it too. He thinks that these are just people following almost like a liberal script. And then the Mouth kind of challenges that and says, so when are you moving out? Meaning, if you hate it so much here, why don't you leave? And that kind of surprised him. And then he mentions his girlfriend. And he only mentions his girlfriend because the Mouth mentions something. And his girlfriend, I think, is talking to someone else in an inappropriate way, I think. I'm not entirely sure. And I wondered why he hadn't thought of his girlfriend. Like, she was in scene with him the whole time. Why didn't his interiority have a single thought on her until someone else asked? Like, if you're at a party with someone, I think you think of that person. But maybe that's intentional. Maybe it's meant to surprise us. Again, I saw some lines where I kept highlighting and going, this is so powerful. Like, this is beautifully written, powerful imagery. There's some really, really impactful lines here. But in my opinion, it's doing too much zooming out. There's way too much theory and talks of themes and feelings and big picture things about almost like ephemeral, amorphous things, and not enough scene work. I needed more scene work. I needed more of the essentials that go into a scene, everything from tension, character building, to conflict, everything. We also go back in time twice. The first line is him mentioning something that started 4 years ago, which was getting let go of his job. And then in the second page, we have what happened after college. So we go back in time twice. And so I thought that it was a little bit like too much in the catching up territory. For me, this is not the most compelling way to frame it. But I have to read a line that like I loved so much. In the end, we agreed I was being let go, like carp, returned to my natural state of unwork with no hard feelings, despite the hole in my lip and the memory of asphyxiation in their care. That was really beautifully written. Like, again, and this was not the only one. There were some really powerful lines here. I almost wonder if it might be a good exercise for you to write a screenplay first for this. So you have to force yourself to do scene work since you're so cerebral. I mean, I'm diagnosing you, but I think that's my theory on this writer. So I almost wonder if like you had to write a screenplay for at least one scene, if that wouldn't propel you into grounding us a little bit more. But again, it might just be a matter of a stylistic choice and a book that's not for me, which is also fair.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, your thoughts?
All right. I mean, I think my confusion of like my interpretation of events was I found the pages a bit confusing in terms of trying to figure out what was going on. I think the biggest thing missing here, which Cece touched on, is scenes. There aren't really any scenes. So at the end of the day, I think this person pitched it as literary. At the end of the day, I would probably call this experimental fiction. The fact that there are no, the characters are all like the narrator's called the narrator. And the way that this is being told in that, I'm just wondering like how much of this is conscious, I guess, the fact that there's no scenes, the fact that there isn't a lot of world building, or it's like, this is a draft and we're seeing a draft and like all this stuff is going to get layered on. Because if this is the way that you imagine this book to be, this definitely to me is experimental fiction and not literary fiction. So I think that would be just something I wanted to flag so you can kind of like understand the difference. I put a definition of experimental fiction in my notes for you so you can see it and just see if that's something that makes sense to you, because there is a difference between literary fiction and experimental fiction. And this is definitely veering onto the side of experimental fiction for me, because it felt distant. And again, I was still waiting for, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, yeah, how much of this is intentional? How much of this is, there's still a lot of work to be layered on. And again, that's fine. We understand that there are still many drafts to go with writing your book. And obviously that's fine. So yeah, I would just flag the fact that there's no scenes is interesting to me. And it was hard for me to really kind of connect. I was also waiting for the world building. Like even when we were talking about the kind of, I'm going to call them like capitalist worker bros or whatever you want to call them, right? Like the cogs in the capitalism machine, talking about, you know, how they're interacting with this world. But I had to do a lot of my own work to imagine that. Like I was imagining the way that I think capitalist worker bros go to work and the buildings they work in. And you at no point described to me what your version of capitalist working bros were looking like. So that's the kind of thing that I stumbled upon with this one. I'm just wondering what version of a draft we got is really, I guess, my end point.
Great, Carly. Thank you. Okay, we're now going to move across to Cece's query. Will you read that for us, please?
Dear Cece, discovering the shit no one tells you about writing during the pandemic, when it was just me and my husband in a new city, was like finding a lifeboat at sea. You were a friend and teacher I clung to. Between the great stories and insights you and Carly share and Bianca's go-getter personality, I have learned much about the craft, lessons I desperately needed, so thank you. Cece, even though you picked apart a previous query of mine, and rightfully so, I'm choosing courage over fear and submitting to you once more since you are seeking high-concept fantasy and stories about dysfunctional families. I'm hoping your incredible insights will help me improve this query in 5 pages so that I might have the courage to query it one day. What if Snow White was the evil queen? Redacted, 70,000 words, is YA fantasy that reimagines Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Little Red Riding Hood, and a splash of Cinderella. It is for fans of Gilded by Marissa Meyer and Snow White and the Huntsman directed by Rupert Sanders, and has series potential. 14-year-old Ruby Rose wakes up in a castle straight out of the fairy tale she fell asleep reading instead of her modern-day bedroom, unsure how she got there. A witty and bossy chambermaid, Millie, claims Ruby is the princess, yes, her, and the evil queen, as in her stepmother, demands her prompt presence. Soon, Ruby Rose finds herself escorted by a scary knight called Bashful, so unlike the dwarves she read about, to meet the queen, Snow White. And if Ruby knows her fairy tales well, she knows it's only a matter of time before the evil queen demands her daughter's death. On the run with the chambermaid in Bashful, Ruby unravels the secret plots and strange magic of the realm that brought her there to fulfill a prophecy. To escape this twisted fairy tale and return home, Ruby must defend Snow White. I am a writer, recovering teacher, and a new mother living in Redacted. I have previously won web novel awards for romance and science fiction novels. My screenplay has made quarterfinal and semifinal stages in 3 screenplay competitions, and I have secured a shopping option agreement on other work. Currently, I'm busy drafting a Medusa retelling set in a futuristic world. Redacted is my debut fantasy novel. I have included the first 5 pages as per the guideline. Sincerely, Redacted.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, what was the word count there and what was your take on that?
The writer included the word count for us. So this person said that the query letter is 403 words with the first paragraph, which was really for the podcast, and 275 words without it. Okay, so from the very top, First of all, thank you so much for your kind words. These are lovely, lovely words. And can I just say that framing it as choosing courage over fear is a wonderful way to write it. I really liked that. It was really inspirational. I saw a small typo, which I corrected when I read it out loud. It reads, I'm hopes your incredible insights will help. I'm pretty sure you mean I'm hoping. Typos are fine. Typos happen. I'm really letting you know because why not? Okay, so first paragraph with all the metadata. Very important paragraph. So two things. One, you're saying this is a reimagining of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Little Red Riding Hood, and a splash of Cinderella. In my opinion, it's really just a reimagining of Snow White. And I'm saying just, but not in a bad way. Like just is great in this case. I don't see Little Red Riding Hood and I don't see Cinderella in the plot. Maybe I'm wrong. I personally think I love mashups. Okay, so if you're going for a mashup, cool. But then the plot paragraphs need to be altered because I don't get how we're talking about Little Red Riding Hood or Cinderella. But I honestly think that just a reimagining of Snow White with Snow White as the evil queen is already so cool. Like, it's such a cool premise. I don't remember critiquing this the first time, but I'm pretty sure I said that it was a cool premise because it is. So I don't think you need to add more things. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe another comp too. I think that comping it to Snow White and the Huntsman, the movie, might be too direct, might be too like it's another Snow White reimagining. So something to think about as well. The first plot paragraph ends with, if Ruby knows her fairy tales well, she knows it's only a matter of time before the evil queen demands her daughter's death. Her daughter meaning her, right? Because she woke up as her daughter. I thought it was a little confusing. The framing, I had to read it again. Wait, does she have a daughter? She being the protagonist? And I know that it's not actually unclear, but just given how many query letters agents read, I'd reframe that. But not just from a rewriting the sentence line. I also thought to myself as I read this, from a plot perspective, wouldn't it be so much cooler if she overheard the queen plotting something as opposed to just being like, well, I know the fairy tale, so this is coming up. I feel like it would be a much more compelling way to set her on the journey. So I would consider changing that. Yeah, I really liked this. I really liked everything else. I thought that it was really well written, really cool. I do think that, again, like I said in the beginning, I don't think that you need all the fairy tale mashups because I really, really liked it.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, we're throwing it to Carly to hear her thoughts.
All right. I definitely agree with Cece. It seemed to me like you were trying to do a lot, you know, with the comps of like the Seven Dwarfs, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella. These are all three separate stories, right? And so I was a bit confused by like where the mashup was coming in. And obviously once I got into the pages, it seemed very much like it was the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I just want to comment on the age, right? So a 14-year-old, that's kind of on the young YA side, but it's 70,000 words. So I'm like, that all aligned to me. It wasn't like, oh, something feels out of whack. It just felt like a tighter YA. And obviously YA is a huge category, right? It does really span from like 13 to 18. And which if we all remember being those ages, and like 13-year-olds and 18-year-olds are very different in terms of their life experiences. So this just felt like a young YA, but not in a bad way, like in a good way. It totally worked for me. The one question mark I had was the return home piece, right? So it says like she wakes up in a castle straight out of the fairy tale instead of her modern day bedroom, unsure of how she got there. So I don't know. I'm like, I think that you explained it really well. And then at the end, you're like, to escape the twisted fairy tale and return home, must defeat Snow White. Like, I loved all of that framing, but I was just curious about like, at some point, does she remember her real world or does she start to forget it? I don't know. I just like that kind of time slip bit. And, you know, if you're only counting the 275 words as the word count, you do have a little bit of room there. So that would be something that I'd be curious about. But I think you did a really good job. The only thing I want to comment on just from an industry perspective is you said, I've secured a shopping / option agreement. On another word, shopping agreements and options are different things. So as an industry person, I'm kind of like, did you mean one or the other? Or did you mean you have a shopping agreement for one project and you have an option for another? So that is just something, as I said, as an industry person, I'm flagging. And that's obviously the type of stuff that stands out to me when I read query letters.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, what was in those opening pages?
So we have a prologue. So Snow is in the tunnels trying to escape with Happy. She's in labor. At one point, she says she can't leave him behind, to which Happy responds that Prince Charming won't abandon the castle and that he's tasked them with her safety. She looks for Bash and can't find him and learns that he stayed behind with the prince. Then Snow tells Happy the castle has fallen and they won't make it out alive. Snow tells Happy the baby is coming and they won't reach the meadow in time. They decide to carry her, they being Happy and I'm assuming his brothers. And then we have a narrator voice that says, "So begins the tale of the once sweet Snow White who became evil, destined to be slain by her own child." Then we have chapter one. Ruby Rose is asleep, wakes up, drops a book, tries to find it in the dark. A flash of lightning strikes, and she realizes she's no longer in the room. And then we have chapter two, in which she's trying to navigate the room and realizes that it looks exactly like Snow White's room from the fairy tale she was reading before she fell asleep.
Awesome, Cece. Okay, Carly, we're going to ask you first what you thought of those opening pages.
I'm going to be honest, like, I don't actually think I have all that many notes, which always surprises me because I'm always like, what's going on with me? What did I forget to drink my coffee this morning? Because I think, like, it does what it sets out to do, which I think is very sweet and cute about it. It's a young YA. The prologue short. Chapter one is short. Chapter two is short. Like, it's short and punchy. It's cute, but also like has high stakes. I don't know, maybe as I said, I woke up on the wrong side of the bed and I don't have a lot to say today, but like I actually think it's super cute and I think you did a great job.
Here are all of our listeners being like, can Carly wake up on that side of the bed when she's critiquing our work? Love it. Okay, Cece, your take on that.
I'm very sorry, but I did not wake up on the wrong side of the bed. I have a lot of notes. Okay, so first of all, this starts with princess, this way, hurry, dialogue. This is a hill I will die on. Start your books with interiority. Do not begin your books with dialogue. It's a stylistic choice. It's not something that's wrong with it. But seriously, it's going to make it better. Try. Just try. A challenge to everyone out there. Try beginning with interiority and tell me it's not better. Convince me that your book is not better. Okay, now I do want to talk about something that I actually think is objective. I was really confused by three different plot points in the prologue. And the prologue is very short, which, by the way, kudos to you, it should be short. One, she is in the tunnels, clearly escaping. She's not forced to be there. This is very clear that she's there and she's meant to be there. And then she says to Happy, I can't leave him behind. I will not leave him behind. I don't get it. If she's in the tunnels running, then why is she saying she can't leave him behind? She knew she was leaving him behind when she got in the tunnels. And if she didn't, your interiority is supposed to tell me that. There's supposed to be a line that goes, she was expecting him to be here. Without him here, she's changing her mind, right? She's going to turn around and go back. Second plot issue in the prologue. All of a sudden, she tells Happy, the castle has fallen, dear Happy. They won't make it to us alive. How does she know this? Is this news to Happy? If it is news to Happy, then why isn't anyone reacting? Wait, the castle has fallen? This is news? Or did they already know this? I suspect it's the latter. And if they already know this, why is she telling him this? Like, you know the castle has fallen. You're trying to escape. My point is, it feels info dumpy. Which I know, I'm ripping it apart again. I'm being mean again. I'm sorry, but truly, you should look into this. It's going to make it better to rely on interiority as opposed to dialogue to say things that the characters already know. Or if they don't know, establish that they don't know, right? And how does she get this new info? Is she clairvoyant? Okay, three. Then, after saying this, she says, we won't reach the meadow in time, my friends. The child is coming. So now she's back to wanting to escape. But two sentences ago, she had said that she couldn't leave him behind. Like, I'm not saying that someone can't change their mind or oscillate between leaving or not. But again, it only makes sense if interiority is adding context, right? We should see her emotions. We should see her thoughts. Oscillating, if that's the case, if she is oscillating, right? Like maybe she's going, I can't leave him, I don't know. And really, this bothered me because it felt like you were using dialogue to establish information and it felt really info dumpy. I have so much empathy for movies and TV shows because there's no interiority in these mediums and they have to establish information often through dialogue. And it is really hard to do without it sounding info dumpy. But remember, you have a superpower. You have the fact that you can access a character's psyche as they process information. Like, you're a storyteller. You can play God. That's your power. So I would go deep into this person's psyche, into Snow's psyche, and share whatever's going on through her head while we are in scene. So the scene can be that much stronger, I promise you. And then another thing. The prologue ends with a very voicey narrator, which I really liked. This was a really cool voicey narrator. And it reads, and so began another tale, a dark and grim tale, a tale about the once enchanting sweet princess Snow White and how she became the evil destined to be slain by a child. And not just any child, her child. That is good. Come on. Like, all of you applause. Snaps for this writer. if you begin your prologue with this voicey, fairy tale-like narrator, you're going to bookend your prologue so nicely. So I know this is like kind of like me repeating my first note about the hill I'm going to die on, but you're just proving my point for me. You can write interiority really well. Let's see that. Let's have that cool voicey thing to voice the prologue. I thought it was really good. So let's have that. Okay, another thing. Sorry, on the prologue. Given what we see of her in the tunnel, talking to Happy, Bash isn't there, the prince is behind, the castle has fallen. And then we have the cool voicey narrator. I don't get how what we saw leads to her becoming evil, but maybe that is intentional. If that is intentional, cool, no worries. My question to you is it intentional? I don't understand how what we see happening in scene, her making her way through the tunnels, is supposed to indicate that she's going to become evil. If we are supposed to understand, rewrite this. If we're not supposed to understand, awesome. Just so you know, like I'm just letting you know it's not something that's clear. Chapter 1 and chapter 2, she's alone, right? And you did an amazing job considering that she's alone because she's almost like talking to herself. And whenever a character is talking to themselves, I'm always like, oh, I don't buy this. I buy it. I buy that she's talking to herself because you framed it in a way that's very convincing. I'm still not entirely sure that we need as many pages as we got of her figuring out that she's in another room. I kind of wanted it to move a little faster. Maybe the issue is that we're not getting emotions on the storm. Like the room is entirely dark, is super dark, right? And then we get like lightning. There's a storm. Is she afraid of lightning? Like how someone reacts to a storm says so much about them. My little sister, who is in her 30s, is still afraid of storms. So that's super cute. I don't know. When I see a storm, I always think, like recently my dog passed away. I always think like if Baba were here, like he'd be afraid of the storm. Things like how someone reacts to a storm says a lot about them. So maybe add emotionality about the storm. I'm not sure. But I wanted, I guess, more on how she's feeling as opposed to just her processing the fact that all of a sudden she's in a new place. A question that I don't need to be answered now, but I would like to be answered at some point. She is a 14-year-old. Why did she fall asleep reading Snow White? No shade, but it's unusual. Like 14-year-olds are typically not reading Snow White. And I kind of wanted to know why. You know, is it like an interesting quirk of hers? Is she going to play Snow White in the play at school? And so she's trying to read the fairy tale to kind of get into character. I don't know, something else. But I do want to compliment you on the things you're doing well. There's a very cool narrator voice. You did an amazing job considering she's alone and her navigating and like talking to herself. It felt like she was interacting with someone, even though she wasn't. Her processing the information, like, am I dreaming? She must be dreaming. That was really well done too. So there's a lot that is working. And I do think you should keep the prologue. I'm not saying scrap the prologue, but I think the prologue means a lot of plot work right now.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, for our listeners out there, I've been reading a lot of work lately from other writers, and something that I'm seeing an issue with is reactions, because we are constantly reacting to our environment. Somebody says something, we react first in our thoughts or our emotionality, then we calibrate. Did this person mean it in this way? Did they mean it in this way? And we may say something to them, but we may feel completely differently. But there's always going to be these kinds of reactions bouncing off of each other. And I'm seeing in a lot of work where something kind of big happens and the character just kind of moves on without us taking that pause to really see how they're reacting to it. And how they react to it, as Cece said, tells you a lot about the character. And in the great words of Joey Tribbiani, reacting is not acting again. So just remember that. Right, Carly and Cece, as always, thank you so much for your wonderful insights. Really appreciate them. And now let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app,
It really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th. For a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there. Welcome, listeners. Today's guest is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the Divergent series, the Carve and the Mark duology, the End and Other Beginnings collections of short fiction, Chosen Ones, and many short stories and essays. She lives in Chicago. It is my pleasure to welcome publishing phenomenon, Veronica Roth. Welcome, Veronica.
Hi. What an intro. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here with us. So the book we're discussing today is When Among Crows. And Veronica, I'm going to need your help with the pronunciation of some of these names because I don't want to butcher them. So is it Demeter?
Demeter, yeah. I'm going to be American about my pronunciation. Okay. I don't speak Polish, so I'm going to do my best also.
Very fair. What about, is it Allah? Allah? Is it?
Allah, yeah.
Allah. And then Zmora?
Zmora is right. Yeah.
Okay. So let me tell you, lovely listeners, a little bit about Veronica's book, When Among Crows. Here's the jacket copy so everyone can learn more about it. When Among Crows is swift and striking, drawing from the deep well of Slavic folklore and asking if redemption and atonement can be found in embracing what we most fear. We bear the sword and we bear the pain of the sword. Pain is Demeter's calling. His family is one in a long line of hunters who sacrifice their souls to slay monsters. Now he's tasked with a deadly mission. Find the legendary Baba Yaga. To reach her, Demeter must ally with the ones he's sworn to kill. Pain is Allah's inheritance. A fear-eating Zmora with little left to lose, Allah awaits death from the curse she carries. When Demeter offers her a cure in exchange for her help, she has no choice but to agree. Together, they must fight against time and the wrath of the Chicago underworld. But Demeter's secrets and his true motives may be the thing that actually destroys them. So as you can see, very compelling jacket copy indeed. And we get to pick Veronica's brain for the next 30 minutes or so. So question, first question, Veronica, can we talk about the Polish folklore and the character of Baba Yaga and how this inspired this modern fairy tale?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Polish, like my family's Polish, but I grew up in Chicago, which has like a big immigrant population from Poland since World War II, I think, was like the main surge. But I, for a long time, like didn't feel like I had permission to explore that part of my identity because I don't speak the language and because, you know, I'm like one layer removed. My mother is European and I'm American. So I felt like, oh no, I can't claim that heritage. And then, I don't know, at some point in the recent past, I had a conversation with a friend who I would describe as actually Polish. And he just said to me, like, there's a lot of ways to be Polish in Chicago. And I don't know why that was. It almost like made me feel like, okay, well, maybe I can look into this folklore and learn more about it and connect with this part of my heritage. And I started learning about Polish folklore monsters because they're basically all vampires is like what I learned. And there are a lot of like wronged women, like something bad happens to a woman and there's this fear about her, like maybe something will happen to her restless spirit and she becomes dangerous. And I just thought that was fascinating. So that sort of started me down this whole journey of learning more about Slavic folklore in general. And I've always loved, you know, contemporary fantasy where there's just a layer of weirdness in the world around you. And, you know, anywhere you look, you could just walk down your everyday like path to the bus stop and you could find something remarkable. Like that idea seems really exciting and interesting to me. So that's kind of where When Among Crows came from and the Polish folklore of it all.
That's so cool. I love how your friend probably had no idea that they were saying something that would have such an impact in you, right? Like there's many ways to be Polish in Chicago. That is brilliant. I'm always amazed at how many people I talk to that they struggle with the same thing you described. Like, am I enough of this heritage? Am I enough of this part of my identity? I think it's beautiful when people embrace the fact that as humans, we can be more than one thing. And that's really cool. That's really awesome. And speaking of Chicago, this book has Chicago vibes again, but this time with magic. What is it about Chicago that inspires your work? And how much fun did you have basing certain scenes in Chicago's neighborhoods and landmarks? Were there any challenges about that? Like, are you too close to it? How did you handle that?
Well, I think my answer to this is like why I set books in Chicago is always kind of unsatisfying. But I live here and I love it here. So I put books here because then I get to kind of like explore it in my mind for, you know, the better part of a year, which is how long it usually takes me to write a book. So I keep setting it here. But I think my relationship to the city is evolving. So with Divergent, when it was set in Chicago, it was like from a kind of distant point of view. I grew up in the suburbs. And to me, Chicago is like this glittering city in the distance that we went to on field trips and stuff. So you can kind of see that, I think, in Divergent. There's just a layer of remove. And it relies heavily on landmarks and, you know, like touchstones that people will recognize about Chicago. And then Chosen Ones, it started to change. That one's also set in Chicago. I had lived here for, you know, I think 7 years at the time that I wrote that book. And then When Among Crows is just a further development of that, I think. It's more set in the neighborhood. Like they don't really go downtown. It feels more like the area that I live in, which is not sexy. You know, like it's just a neighborhood. It has a lot of like collapsing buildings and rundown businesses in it because I'm close to Uptown, which is where part of When Among Crows is set. And there's like an old abandoned theater there. And there's just a lot about this city that's really beautiful and broken and interesting. And I think one of the great things about setting books here is that I can rediscover it. Like you start to look at the world around you in a different way because you're imagining the characters moving through it or, you know, what they would notice or how they would look at it. So it helps you to kind of, I don't know, better appreciate your surroundings when you set a book in the area that you live.
For sure. And you get to process it, like you said, from the outside, which is very interesting. Setting is such an important element when it comes to storytelling in general. And I love that you were able to infuse the various iterations that Chicago has represented to you. So in terms of length, this is a very short book at 166 pages. Some might say it's more of a novella.
Yeah, it is, I think.
Okay, did it start as a short story and then it developed into something longer? Or was it the case of just like, look, this is how long the story has to be And so we're not going to make it longer just because of whatever conventions, right? Like, because I personally love short books.
Yes. So I set out to write a novella. And that was kind of what I was worried about, is actually that it would grow beyond the limits of the category and become like a short novel, which is just a weird, awkward place. A novella already feels like an awkward place to writers, I think, because, you know, we practice writing short stories, or maybe we've read a lot of novels, so we have a sense of their shape and like how long it takes, you know, to move through the arc of them. But a novella is a little, we're a little less familiar with that, I think, in general as writers. But I wrote one before, Arch Conspirator, which came out last year, 2 years ago. God, what is time? But I had a sense of how long it would be. Arch Conspirator was based on a play, Antigone. So that was like the perfect length to learn how to write a novella, because that's just kind of inherently like play length is novella length, at least in my opinion. But this one, I just had a better sense of it. I had been through it before. I could feel it. And I wanted the story to be, you know, just long enough for this kind of like smaller mission. We're off to see the wizard vibe. I wanted it to be just long enough for that, but also to feel the world of it, like to spend enough time in it that you kind of want to live there in your mind. I think that's a perfect setup for a novella, like a really hearty snack.
I love that. I love that so much. And I feel like you mentioned what is time. Like that is how I feel about time ever since the pandemic. So I guess for the last 4 years at this point, which is so trippy.
I know.
Time has really lost its meaning and it's just become this weird warped thing. But when I'm reading a book, it's totally different. It could be a novella, it could be a short story. It doesn't matter. If I'm immersed in a story and I'm digesting it with my eyes, it is different for me, eyes versus ears, because I usually do something else when I'm listening to a book. But anyway, I get sucked in. And time has always stopped. When I was a kid, time would stop. When I read your first books, time stopped. Like time would stop when you're reading books. And so as a writer, as a storyteller, you're kind of playing with time. And that's really cool. So answer me this. What do you find so alluring about contemporary fantasy? Like taking folklore and putting it in a modern day urban setting. What about this do you think resonates with readers that can say something that other genres of fantasy can't? And as a reader yourself, is that something you gravitate towards for fun, not for research?
Well, I think contemporary fantasy is a little more accessible to people who are not as like experienced fantasy readers, because, you know, it doesn't ask you to put yourself in a completely new world with completely new rules. It sort of relies on like your existing knowledge of how things function. And things like, you know, cars, currency, plumbing, you know, just the kind of basic everyday rules of your world are present in contemporary fantasy. So there's something nice about that. I really like all kinds of fantasy, so I'm happy to go to a different world or an alien planet or whatever, you know, but I think that does take some practice for a reader to, you know, find your footing and to be patient as a world unfolds around you. And contemporary fantasy does not really demand that level of patience, which is nice, you know, sometimes like a bit of a relief when you're reading it. But the reason I gravitate toward it, and this is really, I think, I mean, Chosen Ones is sort of contemporary fantasy, so I've written it before technically, but Chosen Ones feels like sci-fi. I don't know why or how. Anyway, the reason I like it so much is because it adds a layer of magic to like the ordinary, basically. I came up with this story when I was like walking my dog a lot. I had decided like, okay, it's time. I have a tiny dog and she doesn't really require that much exercise, but I was like, maybe it'll be good for her. So one summer I spent, you know, walking her for like 45 minutes a day, which is longer than I was before. And I came up with this idea, just like looking at these, you know, sort of boring things in my surroundings and wondering like what would happen if they were more interesting, basically, and letting my imagination run wild. So I think contemporary fantasy does that. It's like, what if I open the door to this wardrobe and I walk into another world? There's just something exciting about that idea, especially when you're a kid, but then you never lose that childlike feeling. What if in a second, everything could just be completely different and more magical? I guess.
Absolutely. Because we could all use a little bit of magic.
Yeah. As you said, 4 years into the pandemic, we're kind of like, can we get out? I'd like to get out.
Can we go someplace else, please, right now? So there's a scene in the book where Demeter is with his grandmother when he's a child, and she's teaching him how to spot monsters. And she identifies a woman as being a Smora. And when he asks her how she did it, she says, when you become one of us, you will tap into a wellspring of power within yourself. You can unleash the full extent of that power, or you can let in only a trickle of it. And when you do so, you will see the monstrous parts of our world for what they really are. It requires tremendous control, but you are capable of it. You will become capable of it. This feels like such a metaphor for life, for anxiety, for optimism versus pessimism, for the way we see the world, especially if you're someone who's very sensitive. Was that your intention? Or is that just something that, like, as a reader, we picked up on? And can you speak a little bit more about that?
Well, it's a little funny because, so I don't think it spoils that much to say that Demeter is in a cult. Like, he's born into a cult of monster hunters. And so the speeches that he receives at the beginning, they're supposed to sound reasonable. But as you go through the story, you're like, oh, these people are terrible. I think her speech is like, yes, I believe those things, you know, in optimism and all that. But I'm also like, ooh, this woman is creepy. Like, she's trying to further indoctrinate him into this mindset. And they're basically sitting at this cafe trying to figure out if they want to kill one of the people across the street from them, who's just like going about their everyday business. So that's all I could think about when I hear this speech. I'm like, oh God, they're just like picking out a target, which is kind of scary. But yeah.
I love that. And what comes to you first, the premise or the character? And how do you take it from there? Like, what's your entry point into a story?
Premise, for sure. Yeah. I don't really figure out like who's supposed to tell the story until later. Sometimes I'll keep a kind of situation in mind for many years before I figure out who's the right person to tell it. Probably the most significant example of that is Divergent. Like, I kind of understood that I wanted this story and this world with many factions, you know, where someone was born into abnegation and chose Dauntless. Like, I had that kind of loose idea in mind, and I just sat on it for a couple of years because I just didn't think the narrator was right. It was initially like Tobias, who's the love interest. It was written from his perspective, and I just was like, I don't, this doesn't seem, it didn't seem interesting because he's a guy, and like we already assume like the entire history of literature is just guys going on adventure. But until I found her, Triss, to tell the story, and she was just like a more exciting point of view, I think, because she wasn't the kind of person you'd expect to leave everything behind and go do something dangerous. So it took me 4 years to figure that out. So that's why I'm like, never throw anything away, please.
I love that. See, this is a really good piece of advice to our listeners, because a lot of people, it's almost like they think that the first person that comes to you to tell the story is the right person just because they were first. And that's obviously not the case, because Divergent wouldn't have been Divergent if it had been from Tobias. I mean, I don't think so. Like, I certainly wouldn't have gravitated towards it. I just don't think I would have. I could be wrong, but yeah.
No, I mean, and I certainly didn't either. So it just didn't work for me with him. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. The person that comes to you, you're like attached to them. You feel like, oh, they came to me first. So that's like a sign. But the thing is, in writing, there's no sign from the heavens. Like, it's just your brain working out a problem. So you get to actually figure out if like the way you originally decided to solve that problem is right or not.
I love that. That is the best advice. There's no sign from the heavens. It's just you. It's just your brain.
It's just you, man. Sorry. I mean, people have different beliefs about this, maybe, but I don't think anyone is like out here claiming to be divinely inspired. So.
And you know, that's just more empowering, because it means that it's your brain, like it's your imagination fueling the creation of an entire world and inhabiting it with people and giving them motivation. Like,
yeah.
You are divine, actually, if you think about it, which is kind of cool. What does your drafting and outlining process look like? Are you a plotter? Are you a pantser? Like, what's your situation?
Well, I'm big into outlines these days. I didn't start that way. But after writing Divergent series and encountering, you know, the consequences of my own actions, I think by the time I got to the third book, I was like, oh, wouldn't it have been nice to plan this better? Yeah, so I've been learning as I go, for sure. And what I do now is I sit down and I make like a big list of scenes that I have ideas for. I go on these long brainstorming walks where I listen to music that just feels like the right music for the story. And then I make a big list of scenes, and then I try and put it in some kind of order. And then the outline just becomes more and more detailed as I go. But then as I'm drafting, like I'll stop at each kind of part, which is like an arbitrary distinction because my books aren't usually divided into parts. I stop and I reassess, and I usually redo portions of the outline, like factoring in things I've discovered as I draft. Because sometimes you write something in the outline and you think it's going to work, and then you sit down to write it and you're like, well, this is terrible. So what do I do now? And I don't believe in sticking to a plan that's not working. So I remake my plan as I go. There's a little pantser in there, right?
Yeah, I feel like it's a mix. I feel like you allow for both worlds. I kind of want a museum of every writer's process. You know, like I would go to that museum and see like the original outlines and the post-it notes and the sticky, like everything. I would go to that museum in a heartbeat. Sounds really
interesting. Yeah, and it's kind of crazy that we all arrive at the same place in the end. Sometimes I'll talk to a writer and be like, I don't know how that works. I talked to a writer recently who was like, oh, I don't see things in my head as I write. Like, I don't.
I heard that there are people who don't see things in their heads. I heard about this. Yes.
Yes. And I was like, how do you? That's my entire process of seeing things in my head. So I just couldn't imagine. She's like, it takes effort for her to describe things because she just doesn't care that much about them. So she has to like go back and kind of work that in. Anyway, it's just really fascinating. Like, well, you also write books, so.
I've had that conversation, but with an editor. When she's editing her clients, her author's works, she doesn't see things in her head. Like when she thinks of her husband, she doesn't picture him. An image of him does not come to her head. An image of it's not personal to her husband, by the way. Like that's just not how her brain works. And actually there are people who are like this. It's just a different way of your brain processing information. And, you know, always are great. But I'm like, how do you do your job? And she does it. And she's a fantastic editor. So, yeah, I don't know. People.
Maybe she does it better because she's not relying on like, you know, because your brain supplies a lot of information when you envision things. So maybe she's just focused on like what's on the page, which is
that's an excellent point. I love that. Yes, maybe it's even better. Okay, so you were 22 when you wrote Divergent, which is like the most impressive thing ever. All these years later, what would you go back and tell your young writer self? Something that you wish you'd known, something that you feel would be helpful. And don't say that you wouldn't say anything because it led you to this point. Like, just imagine that it's not going to ruin where it leads you.
Okay, but that, you are asking a sci-fi writer about time travel. So this
is exactly what
I want to say. It's like, well, what if when I went back and told her, altered the course of history? You know?
It won't mess up anything. I promise. Just in this hypothetical situation, it will not.
What would I tell her? I don't know. All the things like I would actually tell myself at 22 have to do with personal stuff. Like, I don't know, go on medicine. Fill in your eyebrows, you know, like all these things. But in a more like professional sense, plan things out more. That would be good. And especially with like world building rules, I feel like when I've gone back to read those books, my first books, I think about how often I break my own rules in order to facilitate like a particular emotional moment, you know, in the text. That doesn't work because when people, like, obviously it works for some people, like people liked those books and I like them too. But I think in order for people to experience an emotional moment in a book, they have to feel like they're standing on solid ground. That ground is not going to move beneath them. And so when you break your own world building rules, you sort of undercut that experience and you're taking away the potential for your reader to really immerse themselves in your story and to experience the emotion that you want them to feel. So that is one of the main things that I've learned in the last decade since those books came out. I don't know, maybe that wasn't as like, maybe that's too specific for your question.
No, it's not. No, it's perfect because it honestly just tells me that it's so refreshing to see someone who thinks of the beginning of their career in the way that you do. It's truly a privilege. And I guess for our final question, this is something we ask of our guests. Can you recommend us a book? It could be a book that you haven't read yet, but you're excited to read. It could be a book that you devoured. It could be a classic, anything. Recommend us a book, please.
Yeah, okay. So I just read a book by Yume Katase called The Stardust Grail. She wrote, her first book came out last year. So that one is called The Deep Sky. Stardust Grail is like a kind of Indiana Jones style adventure through a universe that has like many alien races. So it's definitely sci-fi. Super interesting, a very fun read, but with a kind of really strong emotional underpinning and exploration of how we would understand races of people if they like were not, if they didn't process information the way that we did, how could we possibly share any kind of morality with them? Those kind of questions come up a lot, and I really loved it. I loved it a lot. And I think it's out in June, so might be good timing. Put it on your TBR.
That is exciting. Well, everyone, add that to our TBRs. Let's do that. And thank you so much. Thank you so much, Veronica, for joining us. It's been truly an honor. I don't know. You're going to go into the list of the really cool authors we've spoken to. And I'm going to get nervous every time I think about this interview. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and CC Lira are agents at PS Literate Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and CC on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literate Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000 word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.